Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Vivid Life Radio. Join us at vividlife.me to tap into your ultimate life resource. Keep in touch through our weekly radio shows on Vivid Life Radio and stay connected through our Facebook and Twitter posts. I'm your host, Roseanne, and we also have Shane Travis hosting with us today. Hi, Shane.
Hi, guys. Welcome, and great to have you on the show. I'm glad you tuned in to listen, and hope you're having an absolutely amazing day, and we hope you look forward to our guest today.
Yeah, we have got Rick Hansen. He's a neuropsychologist who's written Buddha's Brain. But before I actually bring Rick on, because we've got him there, I'm pretty certain, I'm going to just remind you about our featured travel partner, Sacred Earth Journeys. They're getting ready to visit India in February, and I really think you got to check that stuff out because it looks like it's going to be a fabulous trip. Didn't you check out the information, Shane?
On the India trip? Yes, I actually was going to go on the India trip. It looks like an absolutely amazing mind-opening trip as well as a good spiritual and yoga experience. One of my goals is to get on that trip to India. However, we're not going to be able to make that trip, but I'd love it if all of you could make that trip and then comment and let us know how you enjoyed, because Sacred Earth Journeys is such a wonderful, wonderful company that we at Vivid Life here are partnered with. And Roseanne has been on a trip to actually Peru with them.
Yep.
And Roseanne and I are both getting ready to plan our trip to Ireland.
Yes.
With Sacred Earth Journeys coming this September.
Yes, and we've also got before that, not us, but Sacred Earth Journeys is going to Greece in June, and then both Ireland and Peru again next September. So lots of great destinations. Go to sacredearthjourneys.com. You can get all the details. And join us in Ireland, eh, Shane? Wouldn't that be great to have some
It's going
to
be amazing. We're doing the tour of the mysteries of Ireland, going to be going through all of the sacred lands of Ireland and all the small little islands around Ireland, as well as we're going to be going to a lot of the castles and being led by one of the spiritual gurus of Ireland. So it's going to be a wonderful experience there.
It is going to be. Now, I'm going to start introducing our guest and then bring him online, because we've got some eager listeners already tuned in and want to hear everything that he has to tell us about Buddha's Brain. But we've got Rick Hansen. He's a neuropsychologist who's written and taught extensively about the essential inner skills of personal well-being, psychological growth, and contemplative practice, as well as about relationships, family life, and raising children. He founded the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom, and you can find out more about that at wisebrain.org. Now, Dr. Hansen's latest book is Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. And, you know, when you think about it, Jesus, Moses, and Buddha, and other great teachers, really, were born with brains built essentially like anyone else's. Then they used their minds to change their brains in ways that changed history. Now, it's really well referenced and grounded in science. And the book is full of practical tools and skills that the readers can use in daily life to tap the unused potential of the brain, and we can find out exactly how much is unused, and rewire it over the time for greater peace and well-being. So I'm really excited to welcome Rick Hansen to the show, and you can find out more information at buddhasbrain.com, I believe. Hi, Rick. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. That was a great lead-in.
So they can find out more information at both wisebrain.org and buddhasbrain.com, is that correct?
That's correct. There are a lot of resources there that are freely available to people, and that's my whole hope, just to share tools to people so they can use themselves.
Oh, that's super. This is a really, really fascinating topic, because what I really like about it, again, is this kind of merging of science and spirituality again. I love examples where we're really starting to see this bridge between these two, what used to seem to be such separate studies and areas of thought. Why do you think we're seeing more and more of that?
Yeah, well, throughout history, people have been really trying to have mental states, and I'm using the word mind really broadly here, mental states of happiness, love, and wisdom. and they developed many, many methods for doing that that worked really great. All of them, though, affect the brain in some way or another, which is how they work. I happen to believe there is, in fact, something transcendental mysteriously involved in our lives, but that said, other than whatever that wonderful X factor is, the bottom line, to be kind of biological about it, is that it boils down to the 3 pounds of tofu between your ears, you know? And so you have all these mystics, these meditators, the contemplatives, and the world's great traditions. The one I know best is Buddhism, which has probably the most connection with Western science, but the other traditions as well had the same thing, people really working with their minds, which meant that they were working with their brains, but they didn't know exactly what they were doing. And that's the breakthrough that modern science gives us today. It's a little bit like the alchemists in the Middle Ages could do amazing things putting different chemicals together, but they had no deep understanding of what was going on. But now neuroscience has given us ways to peer into the black box and expose its circuitry. So now we can kind of literally, with our minds alone, reach down inside there and make changes that will transform our lives.
Okay. So how exactly does, you know, meditation and mindfulness change the brain? Like,
sure.
It is actually rewiring it then?
Yeah, it's interesting that partly because it is airy-fairying, has been controversial. Meditation and mindfulness have been the most researched psychological activities in terms of their effects on the brain. So there are literally thousands of studies on meditation. And one of the recurring findings is that when people meditate or do any kind of focused mindfulness practice, like let's say yoga or things like that, what they do is they get changes that are temporary. In other words, they change the state of the brain for the moment. But if they do meditative practices routinely, they actually change traits. In other words, enduring features in the brain. For example, studies have shown that people who meditate routinely literally thicken the neural tissues in the parts of the brain that are involved in controlling attention, which makes sense,
right,
as well as sensing the interior state of the body.
Okay. So we're able to actually see physical changes within the brain, and is that the main difference between the brain and, I guess, the mind? Is that how we're... You know, the mind is more thought and the brain is more physical?
Yeah, if you think about it, it's a little bit like, for example, to use a TV, let's say. The screen of the TV is physical, but what flows across that screen in terms of a movie we're watching or, you know, the text ticker at the bottom of CNN is information.
Right.
The same thing is true with the brain and the mind. In other words, the brain is physical, but it moves immaterial information around, and that's the mind, broadly defined. In other words, neurons signal each other, and they store information, and they move it around. In a sense, like the heart moves blood around, the brain moves, or in the nervous system broadly, moves information around. Most of that information is outside of awareness. But as we evolved and the brain got increasingly complex, we now have these layers and layers and layers of information that built up so that at the highest level, you know, what the tip of the iceberg above the waterline is available to us in terms of conscious thought. So as people, it's kind of radical, but to me it's wondrous and gratitude-inspiring to realize that what people are doing right now, listening to this talk, us talk, thinking about it, you know, planning their weekend, whatever they're doing,
right,
all that is produced by gushy neurons, 100 billion of them, inside their skull.
Right. And really, I guess, through meditation, are we allowing new neurons to fire in new patterns? Is that what brings about the states of happiness and peacefulness and all that?
Yeah. For example, if people think about, like, what did they have for breakfast this morning, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or what did they do yesterday night? What they'll do is they'll pull up a memory, and there'll be knowledge in there, and there'll be maybe a little mini movie of what they did. Obviously, that information that they're pulling up is based on a change in the brain. It's not entirely clear how that happens, but there's no scientist seriously who doubts that that mental record is based on some change in neural structure.
Right.
There's a famous saying in neurology that when neurons fire together, they wire together. In other words, what builds neural structure is mental activity. And so as, for example, now much of that mental activity just kind of comes and goes, you know, and it changes
mm-hmm.
neural structure momentarily, a little bit like, you know, on the TV screen, you know, the pixels on the physical screen are changed momentarily, right, by the football game that
right.
people are watching that's streaming by. But in a computer, for example, when people save a file, like they save a picture to memory or they are writing some kind of letter to a friend and they save it to memory, at that point they're permanently or they're changing the actual structure in an enduring way of the underlying physical basis of memory in their computer. The same thing happens in the brain. The more that you get neurons firing and the longer they fire and the more intensively they fire, the more that they wire together for better or worse. That means that if people put their attention repeatedly on angry quarrels with their in-laws, you know, or their worries about the world or, you know, angry self-criticism, they're unfortunately building neural structure right there. On the other hand, if they practice in different ways, not just in meditation, but in different ways by putting their attention on positive themes and happy experiences, particularly the little things of daily life, then gradually what they're doing is they will be building neural structure related to those positive experiences, which leave an enduring residue in their own brain. And over time, that then results in a change in their mind. In other words, they become happier, more confident, and more resilient.
Okay, makes sense. Now, I know, Shane, you've been enjoying the book very much, and you've got some questions for Rick as well. Why don't you go ahead and share a little bit about what you've been getting out of the book.
Yes, I've been really, really enjoying the book, and I had studied Buddhism before, as well as Hinduism and other religious or spiritual practices, and I really like how you uncover are bringing across the message to people actually how the thinking and messages of Buddha help to train your brain and to run your life. And from what you were saying in regards to basically what you think is what you tell your neurons to do, and then your neurons, now I'm not a neuroscientist or whatnot, but what you're basically saying is that what you think is what you tell your neurons, and then they transmit that thought, and that is what ends up becoming, or can you elaborate on that for me, or how, I'm not sure if I'm making sense, how that our thoughts are in relation to what happens in our life, even causing our own suffering and our own health or illness?
Yeah, it's interesting that in all the great religious traditions, there's an emphasis on ultimate oneness of everything, and that, as you know, well, Shane, that's certainly the case in Buddhism. In other words, there's a real emphasis in Buddhism, for those who may not know it well, about how everything is connected to everything else. And so it's a non-dual tradition fundamentally. It's similarly, it's interesting that modern science, both in terms of quantum physics and deep ecology, is teaching us the same thing, that everything's connected to everything else. The same is true with the mind and the brain. In other words, it's not that they're separate. The best way to think of it is that there's this physical basis for flows of information. So the physical basis and the information co-arise. In other words, the brain and the mind co-arise. Without the brain, you could not have the mind. But similarly, you need the mind to shape the brain. And the takeaway, though, is that process of mental activity shaping the brain is automatic, and it happens for better or worse. So, for example, if people focus on what, as you know, in the Buddhism are called the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. These are traditional terms that are pretty harsh, but they're very broadly defined. You know what I mean? So hatred includes, just kind of holding a resentment against your next-door neighbor. I mean, that would be the category of hatred. Anyway, if the mind, you know, there's a saying that the mind takes the shape of whatever it rests upon. And that traditional saying that's thousands of years old actually is literally true. In effect, the brain takes the shape of whatever the mind rests upon, thus shaping the mind down the road. So, for example, if people rest their mind upon, which means they're firing neurons, which are then wiring together on greed, hatred, and delusion, their mind and brain as a non-dual, unified, integrated system will increasingly be shaped in that direction. Alternately, if they pay attention to good news around themselves, if they train their mind and therefore their brain to control its attention better and better through mindful practices, and if they cultivate wholesome qualities within themselves, like loving kindness or insight, then gradually, in a very real and earned the old-fashioned way kind of way, they will change their brain over time and thus change their life.
Okay.
So, in essence, how does the... I know if you, it's basically the same concept, change your thoughts, change your life, or what Bruce Lipton talks about is that everything you think you become or what you believe you achieve. So then how, like, neurologically, does your thought process turn that into, like, is there some sort of chemical reaction or what, that from your thought process to your brain that turns that into, like, glitches that cause health ailments or mental disorders or whatnot?
Yeah, let me, if I could, give a couple examples. One that I find, this cracks me up, actually, having recently been in London, is that taxi drivers have to, as you probably know, memorize the streets of London, which are a mess. Right. And so, like a spaghetti tangle.
It's like,
and
the streets of Tokyo.
Yeah, is that? I've never been there. I really
Yeah, I've been to Tokyo, and the subway, basically, like the subway system, when I first looked at the map, to me looked like brain surgery. I was like, how am I going to accomplish this? So go on.
That's right, or like a pile of spaghetti on the floor.
Yeah.
But anyway, so they have to memorize all the streets. Interestingly, there's a part of the brain called the hippocampus. Technically, there are two of them. There's one on each side of the brain. Brain's got two sides to it, basically. Anyway, the hippocampus is involved in remembering images. It does a few other things as well, but that's a key thing. So, for example, if you're memorizing the twisty, turny streets of London, you're really using your hippocampus to remember that imagery. Well, interestingly, at the end of their training, London taxi cab drivers have a thicker hippocampus than they did at the beginning of their training, because that mental activity, memorizing all those twisty-turny streets and using visual spatial skills, that mental activity left a lasting trace behind in terms of building more neural structure. Now, this happens at the microscopic level. If I could, you know, to kind of appreciate the scale here, I'm going to throw a few numbers out. You don't have to remember them, obviously. But it helps to kind of get this scale. So the brain, like I said, about 3 pounds. In the 3 pounds of mushy, you know, tapioca pudding between the ears, it's about 1.1 trillion cells, all right? 100 billion of those are neurons supported by another trillion cells. Those 100 billion neurons, each on the average, make about 5,000 connections with other neurons. Those connections are called synapses. They're like little on-off switches. And because they're on or off, they can send a little bit of information. Like in a computer, they have a 1 or a 0. Well, synapses are like that. Well, if you have 100 billion neurons with 5,000 connections, that's 500 trillion little on-off switches connected in an enormous network, right? So you kind of get a scale, right? 500 trillion little on-off switches. Now, each one of those switches can fire around 5 to 50 times a second. Some of them fire even faster than that. So that means that, you know, literally in the last minute or so, probably about a quadrillion bits of information moved around inside of the heads of people listening to this program. So the point is, it's big, it's fast, and it's complicated, and it's all interconnected. So at the level of neurons, of taxi drivers, you know, who are reasonable people, but they're not college professor types or radio show hosts or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're regular people. But guess what? Those those neurons are firing away. And when you get two neurons making a connection, like people understand that the name of this street, you know, is paired with a word, like that street is Dickens Lane or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they're putting information together. What that means is they're connecting the underlying neurons in ways that are still mysterious, but there's no one doubts that this is what's really happening deep down, that they're connecting the neurons together who map that twisty-turny squiggle, which is the street, with the name Dickens Lane. And as those neurons, or often networks of neurons, fire simultaneously, in other words, they're firing together, that simultaneity they're firing strengthens the synapses, these little connections between them, and actually causes neurons to grow new synapses, as well as become more sensitized to each other in general and get more blood flow, bringing oxygen and sugar, glucose, to them, you know, to kind of fuel them up. See what I'm getting at?
Right.
In other words,
100%.
Yeah, literally at that level. My imagery on that, honestly, as you can tell, I get so inspired by this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and grateful that we've inherited this remarkable organ. I visualize God's finger and Adam's finger almost touching each other at the top of the Sistine Chapel. That's what a synapse is.
Well, 100%, and we are created in divinity, and we are divine. And the more we find out about our brains and our bodies, the more we understand that. And the more we need to be mindful of every thought and feeling that goes through our body, because that really is creating everything from the way your body works neurotically to the way your body works physically, to the way your health is, to the way your mental health is. So we constantly need to be aware of exactly what we're thinking and questioning that all the time to make sure that we're like putting in the proper fuel.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, one of the takeaways for me, it's kind of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, gratitude. Like, oh, my God, literally. You know, wow, fantastic. You know, at the level of biological evolution, we have inherited 600 million years of evolution of the brain on top of 3.5 billion years of evolution of life. I mean, we, each of us, on the day we were conceived, you know, got the lottery. You know what I mean?
Yes,
I was like, oh my God, you can't earn that. You're just given it on the day
you're conceived. Each one of us, when we're born perfect. And you're right, it is like winning the lottery.
Yeah, in terms of the capabilities. But the other side for me is the other side of the sword is responsibility. Just like you're saying, what you think about, whether you just dump that emotional reaction on other people or yourselves, whether you are mean to yourself or compassionate and kind, those choices, moment to moment to moment, leave lasting traces behind.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I talk with people about the importance of being for yourself. For example, you were talking about being affected in the body, like stress. When we're upset, we get a stress reaction. Or if we go through our days caught up in multitasking and being driven and, you know, or even comparing ourselves to other people and not feeling good about ourselves. Whenever we do that, we light up what's called the sympathetic nervous system, the stress-focused fight-or-flight wing of the nervous system. We light it up like a Christmas tree or Hanukkah bush or whatever persuasion is. And every time we do that, we release some cortisol. And, hey, there's a place to that occasionally, including getting excited in a positive way, like, you know, just dancing and having a great time, or being psyched that your kid finally shot a basket in, you know, when our daughter finally shot a basket in, like, fourth grade, you know, little girl basketball, we were so excited.
Aww.
There's a fair amount of cortisol there, too. But chronic cortisol is like acid in the brain. It eats away. It eats away at the hippocampus, which I mentioned earlier. In other words, it makes it harder and harder for people to actually remember things. And the second thing it does is that it stimulates another part of the brain called the amygdala, which is like a big alarm bell inside your head that lights up and starts going blap, 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 any kind of sense of threat. So it's a 1-2 punch in a vicious cycle, chronic stress. And also I should have added, the hippocampus puts the brakes on the amygdala. So in a vicious cycle, chronic stress with cortisol releases sensitizes and turbocharges the alarm bell and weakens the brakes upon it. which then makes you more stressed and reactive and upset and jangled and crank, which then releases more and more cortisol. Exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens.
And it is, like you said at the beginning. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, just like you said, Shane, in the body, that's how it happens.
Mm-hmm. And just like you said at the beginning of your explanation is gratitude. Gratitude is very important. It kind of, like, I wake up every morning and the first thing I do is say that I'm grateful for my body and for my mind and the brilliance that's manifested here on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you put yourself in that state, you put yourself immediately in a state of positivity, because you're looking at around at everything you have to be grateful for, and that's a wonderful way for any of us to start off the day. And if anyone that's listening doesn't currently start off the day by being grateful for everything that they have, it's a real good way to start or kickstart yourself to a day of positivity and absolute gratefulness.
I couldn't agree more, and mm-hmm. it's interesting that I've been thinking more. One thing I tried to do in the book, I'd say the book has, in a way, two levels to it. One level is that for anybody, it's an operating manual plus toolbox for your own brain. And it's
mm-hmm.
designed for regular people in regular life in the middle of, in the middle of the trenches, in a business meeting or stuck in traffic or dealing with two toddlers squabbling with each other or,
mm-hmm.
Working it out with their mate. That's what it is. But at a deeper level, I really tried to think through Buddhism, which I know well and love and I teach, to think it through from the standpoint of evolution, biological evolution, and mm-hmm. neuropsychology. So it's interesting because one system in the brain deals with a sense of, wanting the pleasant, but also frustration and hurt when we can't get the pleasant, which then leads to craving and clinging, particularly
mm-hmm.
one of the three poisons, the greed side. Just like you're saying, gratitude antidotes greed. Because when you wake up and do your practice, what a wonderful practice, and feel grateful, it immediately quiets that system and it says, you've already got plenty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then, go ahead, Roseanne.
I was just going to, because there's a part in your book that you kind of made me think about this, is that your brain, you say that your brain is like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. And, so that makes it a challenge to have that gratitude, I guess, because we tend to have this inherent bias towards the negative, and people are kind of clinging to that side. So how can we stay on that positive side if there is this tendency for the negative to be that much more powerful?
Yeah. Fantastic question. First, we have to realize that even though our deep nature, biologically, as well as whatever may be the case transcendentally, but our deep nature biologically is truly calm and contented and caring, the three C's. That's what Mother Nature has given us. But that home base we get driven from home really quickly whenever we feel threatened or upset. And that then activates all these mechanisms inside the brain that cope with threats over the course of evolution, when things were pretty harsh, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so in the course of that, we were left with this negativity bias, that's what science calls it, which focuses on negative information because, if you think about it, carrots and sticks, if you miss a carrot today, you'll usually have a chance at a carrot tomorrow. But in the wild, over evolution, if we do not avoid a stick today, whap, a predator or a natural hazard or somebody else in our primate group, whap, we die and we don't get a chance at a carrot tomorrow. So, for example, studies have shown in relationships that it takes about 5 positive interactions to neutralize just one negative one.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about it, a negative interaction is like 5 times more powerful than a positive reaction on the average. So therefore, I think it's really important to get on your own side in an active way. To, number one, be very careful about presuming threats. Lots of times we think we're threatened when we're really not, or the threat is a very distant threat. I often think about that going through airports, talking about going to Tokyo, let's say, or London.
Mm-hmm.
You go through airports, you get this sign, at least in the States, threat level orange, threat level orange.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, at that airport, on that day, on your flight, it's threat level green.
Right.
Yeah.
The odds of anything bad happening to you on that day, on that flight, are astronomically small. And
yeah, that's funny. Because today, one of my reflections, I was talking about perception and how misperception causes a lot of grief in your life. And you're right, it is a green level at that airport that day.
Yeah.
And I mean, even being in Canada, I'm getting ready to fly in a couple of weeks out for a trip. And because of everything that I'm hearing, it's again, I know, and I wake up every day positive, and I try my absolute best, which is all you can do. Anyone that's listening, all you can ever do is your absolute best, and don't beat up on yourself. But you try so hard, but you're right, you're constantly dealt from the outside with fastballs of negativity coming at you that you're constantly trying to fight off. So, like I said in the beginning, you constantly have to be aware of your thoughts and where they're going, and not to reject them, but to understand that they're there, and then to release the ones that aren't serving you and focus back on the positive and try and remember that fear is always false evidence appearing real, and that when you hear that orange light at the airport, that's you're bringing that thing, and then you're projecting, oh, I'm getting on the plane, it's going to be attacked by a terrorist, and then I'm going down and I'm going to die, and yada yada yada. You make up the whole story, but in essence you could make up a whole nother story that everything's going to go smoothly. So like you said, it's always a constant struggle between positive and negative, but it's most important to always question anything that comes in that's making you feel uncomfortable, and then release it back to the universe and surround it with positiveness.
Right. It's kind of like a 1-2 punch. To go back to Roseanne's question, on the one hand, we do get a lot of threat messages from the world, and some of them are manipulated, obviously, politically to get a kind of quiet and agreeable populace and all the rest. And others are just almost cultural. You know, there's a saying in journalism, you probably know it, if it bleeds, it leads. I mean, that's why news magazines or TV shows often start with crime, because that grabs people's attention. On the other hand, the other punch, it's a 1-2 punch, is we really are primed to focus on the negative. Like, for example, in a crowded restaurant, I've often noticed that, you know, there's a buzz of conversation, we're filtering it out endlessly, but if someone shifts into an angry tone of voice, the whole restaurant gets quiet to listen. Mm-hmm. What is that over there? You know, this couple is starting to squabble in the corner or something like that, or a parent's irritated with a kid, and the whole restaurant gets quiet.
Right.
You know, we're very primed in that way. So step one is to recognize that we live in a kind of paranoid trance, and we do get too activated around fear. Yes, there are real threats out there. There are real conditions to deal with, and sometimes it's appropriate to have a response of anxiety, because that's a signal to us that there's something to deal with. But on the other hand, you know, the brain evolved to, in effect, make a mistake 99 times to think there was a tiger there when there's really no tiger, to avoid making the one mistake that there was a tiger, in fact, but we missed it. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that's part one. But part two, to go to Roseanne's question, I think that it's really important to focus on good experiences when they happen. Like, I'm really enjoying this conversation, honestly, unusually, to an unusual degree in my experience in doing interviews. And so I'm soaking it in, you know? I'm kind of putting
great.
I'm hanging out with it. I'm letting myself feel good. I'm getting a smile on my face. Sometimes for people, there are little things they can do, like that little half smile Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese Buddhist teacher, talks about. Or put your hand on your cheek or your hand on your heart to call up that sense of warmth and caring. And just for 30 seconds. Only half a minute, privately. Nobody needs to know you're doing it. It's what I call taking in the good. It's the fourth chapter of, you know, Buddha's brain. It's called taking in the good, where you just take it in. You soak it in. And so you reverse it. In other words, you try to become like Velcro for positive experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And just like Shane was saying, have your mind be more like Teflon for negative ones.
Right.
And literally over time, particularly if you do it, you know, half a dozen times a day, this little 30 seconds of soaking in the good experience and feeling like it is sinking into your being and filling your body and becoming rich and intense. If you do that half a dozen times a day or so, within a few weeks, you will have, you know, significantly changed your own brain. And you'll feel it. You'll feel happier, you'll feel more confident, and you'll feel more resilient.
Mm-hmm. So that would be considered an example of mindfulness technique? Like that those are actual techniques that we can be incorporating daily, simple, easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That would be you're using mindfulness to stay with the experience. But you're doing more than simply being mindful. I mean, you're doing it with intention. And part of what makes the experience work, you know, it's the brain at a baseline level. It's very mechanical, you know. And so the more neurons you get firing, and the longer they fire, and the more intensely they fire, the more you're wiring together new positive neural circuitry.
Okay.
So that's where you're, it's like you're using mindfulness. The Buddha, mindfulness is ethically neutral in Buddhism. It's not inherently a positive thing. I mean, honestly, a burglar is very, very mindful. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because you're mindful doesn't mean you're practicing virtue.
No.
You know, or leading to the end of suffering. That's where the intentionality of it comes in. And it is interesting, just kind of like what Shane was saying, the more you take in the good, the more you naturally see the good all around you, and the more you wake up from this paranoid nightmare that so many of us are walking around in.
Yeah, it's totally the way that I've become. I mean, all of us at one point in our life come into consciousness or wake up and realize that the error of your ways, of the error of your thinking is what's causing your suffering, which you speak about in the book. And what I choose to do is when I'm starting to feel like I'm slipping back into beating myself up or even any kind of negative thought pattern, which when you were speaking about earlier, usually happens to me now, I get pretty good control over it when it's just me. But like you were saying, when you walk into a room or you're in a restaurant, is I feel that I adopt the energy of other people. So if someone in the room is having an extremely bad time, even if they're not speaking, you can feel that energy and you start to adopt it. So what I usually do now, and it's a technique that works for me very well, is I always say to myself, breathing in, I calm my body. Breathing out, I smile. And as I say, I smile, I always get a big smile on my face. And I always find that helps me to come shift back to focus and understand that what's going on with them is not about me. And I don't need to be attracting that inside of me and taking that on as my energy. Because then when I do that, I'm now becoming part of the collective. And to me, that's what creates the disease. And then you go on to the next room, and then you've adopted and taken on that virus, the virus of the mind, and you take that, and then you're into the next room and you spread your virus to the other people. But instead, I want to stop it in its tracks, whatever technique you use, and then go into the next room and spread positivity and good and growth instead of taking the negative virus that I've attracted and spreading that.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. It makes me think about the chapters in the book on empathy, which for me were some of the most fun to really explore. If I could say it, one of the things that I'm always haunted by when I hear it is a story that I tell in the book about the two wolves. And this is a Native American story. An elder was asked toward the end of her life, you know, what made her so liked and wise and helpful to people. And she said in brief that she knew that in her heart were two wolves, one of love and one of hate, and everything depended on which one she fed each day. And it's that idea, just as you said earlier, Shane, that what we do routinely for ourselves and how we orient actually makes a big difference over time. So evolution has given us these two wolves. I mean, we evolved to be altruistically cooperative toward us, so fearfully aggressive toward them. And one of the very, it's like we live in a time when so much, like for example, brain science literally has doubled in the amount of information it holds in the last 20 years. We know twice as much about the brain than we did 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Similarly, just in the last 5 or 10 years, the amount of information about human evolution, particularly the last, you know, million years or so, has been really developing. And one of the most poignant facts is that, to put things in perspective, during the 20th century, roughly one man in 100 died due to warfare, one way or another, either fighting or through famine related to warfare. 1 in 100. And that's a lot, obviously. It's a lot. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, in hunter-gatherer cultures, on the average, across literally dozens that have been studied, either in the world today or pulling up archaeological records, something on the order of 1 man in 7 died through violence. I mean, it was low grade. It didn't have a lot of shock and awe, whatever, no nuclear weapons. But it was chronic and violent between bands. So it's important to kind of appreciate that we have this capacity within us toward the wolf of hate. The wolf of love is more central, and we have the power to feed and grow the wolf of love. But we need to, I think, keep a watch out on the wolf of hate. And one thing that I think does sometimes happen in spiritual circles is people are denying or repressing, they're not admitting because they're embarrassed about it, their own aggressiveness and anger.
Mm-hmm.
And if you deny it or repress it, it kind of grows in the basement.
Exactly.
It gets really smelly down there.
It's embracing your dark side, as Debbie Ford says.
Yeah, you got to include it because, again, it's really funny. If you get hateful, to use that term loosely, you know, it's one of the three poisons. If you get hateful toward the wolf of hate, you just grow and feed the wolf of hate, right?
Yeah.
So net, where I was going with this, talking about you moving through a restaurant and picking up the vibes, we have these three kind of dedicated circuits for empathy inside the brain. And we're the most empathic creature on the planet by far. Much more empathic than chimpanzees, and definitely more empathic, you know, than squirrels or frogs or sharks, right? And so, anyway, that's one thing that to me is really interesting, and that's where one of the great, I think, takeaways from brain science these days in a practical way can be found. Because, for example, as I was saying at the top of the show, the part of the brain that tracks the internal state of the body also tracks the emotions of other people. So, for example, when we're feeling a strong feeling, like lots of love or lots of anger or lots of fear or lots of joy, whatever it is, a whole bunch of neurons light up in the insula. That's a part of the brain called the insula, kind of in the middle of the brain. Similarly, if I'm with you, Shane or Roseanne, and hanging out, and I see you also activated with some strong emotions, some of those same neurons in my brain will light up just seeing you have the feeling that also light up when I have that feeling myself. I literally am resonating with you. I literally am feeling on the inside out what it's like to be you. And that's the basis of empathy. What's interesting is that if a person wants to become more empathic, which is incredibly important to do, I think both at the world level, boy, oh boy, oh boy, we need more empathy, right? But even at the most basic practical level, like if you want to figure out your partner better or deal with your brother-in-law or the guy in the cubicle next to you or your customers, you know, empathy is extremely useful. One way to literally build empathy is to tune more in, as Roseanne was saying, through mindfulness into your own body and your own flow of experience, because that will literally, studies have shown, make your own insula thicker. It will add measurable neural tissues to your own insula, which will then enable you to become even more tuned into and capable of reading and understanding the emotions of the people around you. Isn't that cool? That just like
it's
tuning
amazing.
Into your own body, like sitting on the cushion or doing some yoga or stretches or just focusing on your own breathing while you're out walking the dog for 20 minutes. That will literally build out the neural hardware that supports the software of empathy for other people.
Mm-hmm. And when you see someone, recognize them as a reflection of you because they are. And you are a reflection of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's very important. That's when they say in Buddhism, namaste, the spirit in me recognizes the spirit in you. Because we all come from one source and are all divine.
Yeah.
So therefore we should always be recognizing the spirit in the other person as a spirit in you.
Yeah, right.
You know, you touched on a lot of things there that made me think, obviously we're talking a lot about relationships and how we relate to other people, and you did briefly mention, you know, your spouse or things like that. Is the brain geared toward intimacy then? Is it, you know, is this something that we should be able to just pick up, like it lights up in us as well, something like that?
You mean tuning into other people just automatically lights up?
I think, like, as far as relationships go, because I think there's a lot of miscommunication going on out there, and I'm trying to figure out what is it, why is there this, a lot of divorces taking place, and couples are really not happy right now, and
that's right.
What is at the bottom of all of this kind of You know, and I think of intimacy when I think of that, right? Because when you really fully relate and can communicate with each other, there's that empathy and all that, you know, lights up as well. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I've been I started meditating in 1974, so that's quite a while, and I've also been involved in human potential and being a psychotherapist also for about 35 years. So it's interesting. It's made me more compassionate, and it's also made me more tough-minded in the sense that through evolution and through our divine ultimate nature, we have this profound capacity and inclination toward love. It's very interesting that, just to talk about the brain briefly, that arguably the primary driving force in the evolution of the brain over the last 100 million years has been love, broadly defined. In other words, squirrels, for example, birds and mammals have bigger brains than reptiles and fish. They deal with the same environmental challenges, but what do birds and mammals do that fish and reptiles don't do? Birds and mammals raise their young and form pair bonds, often for life.
Right.
Similarly, in primates, there's a direct correlation between the size of the primate, like a monkey or a baboon or a gorilla, a direct correlation between the size of the primate brain and how social their group is. In other words, how large their grooming partner, how many grooming partners they have, or how big the band is. In other words, the bigger the band and the more socially complex the band, the bigger their brain needs to be. And then in human evolution, we started making stone tools about 2.5 million years ago with brains a third our size. The brain has tripled in size over the last 3 million years or so. Most of that new hardware is devoted to relationship capacities, like empathy or language or cooperative planning. So on the one hand, we have the wolf of love, right? This big, fuzzy, furry, wonderful wolf of love. But we also have within us the capacity to feel very hurt in our relationships, angry, selfish. We can, even though we have these marvelous empathic capacities, we can shut them down. I work with couples very often. I'm stunned by how frequently people who really listen to each other, which led them to come together, completely have lost empathy for each other by the time they're sitting in my office.
Right.
And so the tough-minded part of me says, take good care of your relationships. What I see all the time, frankly, is I see people who put more effort into stuff that doesn't matter, like honestly, their golf game, you know what I mean?
Right.
Or learning the latest version of Windows or something like that. Well, okay, be a good golfer, whatever. But put much more effort on getting good at being a good mate, or a skillful parent, if that's what you're also doing. And then do things like use my book or listen to shows like this one or read other books or get training in other areas to become more skillful in those regards. I mean, and then what happens over time is you earn the results. In other words, it's the law of little things. If you just do, just like Jane said, do your absolute best every day. In other words, if you just do your best in this moment and the next moment and the next moment, in the Tibetan saying, if you take care of the minutes, the years will take care of themselves. So I find myself in couples routinely. Honestly, if people focus on, for the next 2 to 3 weeks, treating their partner as well as they reasonably can, and just unilaterally focus on virtue and benevolence, that doesn't mean becoming a doormat. It doesn't mean not speaking truth to power, not naming the truth. But if they unilaterally focus on taking maximum reasonable responsibility for their side of the problem, and focus on being a better partner for a few weeks rather than worrying about whether their partner treats them well, usually that will transform their relationship. And honestly, if you've done that for a few weeks and then you talk to your partner about it and your partner still doesn't budge, then to me, it's either time to go see a therapist or, think about, changing the relationship.
Right.
It's reminding me of a movie that I actually just seen last week, and I'm sure that a number of us have seen the movie. And it has a really powerful message on relationships and spirituality, and that's Avatar.
Yep.
And this is not necessarily a human-to-human or avatar-to-avatar relationship. However, how they had the connection with the animals.
Yeah.
And how what they did is they directly connected themselves to the animals so that they were thinking as the animal, and the animal was thinking as them in order to have a perfect, binded, whole relationship. So in essence, to me, that was a reflection of how we should be having relationships with human beings. We should be taking out the fear, because at first he was terrified of the horse, or the horse's reaction, or the horse's feelings, or whatever energy was going on with the horse or the animal that he was, who was kicking and screaming or yelling, or if it's a human, it's yelling, and or whatever it's doing, it's frustrated, it's angry. Forget those feelings and just worry about connecting with the source. In our case, in human beings, it's the heart connection. And speaking to each other from there, and not speaking to the anger or the frustration or the yelling or the screaming, but always communicating from a place of heart and reconnecting there, and always maintaining and having that connection on a regular basis, and not nurturing the fear part of it, overcoming the fear part of it, and seeing right to the very soul and heart of the individual or being that you're trying to connect with.
I couldn't agree with you more. When I think about, lately I've been thinking about what is the realized brain? In other words, if you believe it's true, which I do, that throughout history many, many people have attained complete enlightenment, and even 10 or 100 or 1,000 times as many have gone very, very far on the path of realization, that, therefore, if there's a realized mind, there's got to be a realized brain, all right? Mm-hmm. Even if it's arises in the divine and is infused by the divine at the physical level, there's got to be some kind of radical transformation in the brain, because mm-hmm. the truth is, biological evolution gave us a brain that uses greed, hatred, and delusion for survival purposes, right? So there's got to mm-hmm. be some kind of transformation. And mm-hmm. I think one of those, if the brain fundamentally has three motivational systems, to approach, to avoid, and to attach. And those systems can be used in ways that are driven by suffering and ignorance, or those systems can be balanced in a way that promotes contentment and wisdom. And, for example, the approach system, when it's balanced, is grateful. The avoidance system, when it's balanced, is peaceful. It's not at war with the world, because that's where I started this riff, Shane, based on what you were talking about there. It's peaceful. There's a wonderful line in the Dharma: give no person cause to fear you, right? That, again, does not mean being a doormat. I mean, it means being straight and being strong and all the rest. I think about the Dalai Lama. I think about Nelson Mandela. Another wonderful movie, I thought at least, was Invictus, which is about the Nelson Mandela and the rugby team, in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Or Thich Nhat Hanh. I mean, they're all deeply, deeply peaceful. I mean, they look at the world, to quote a preacher in America, with quiet eyes. But they totally stood up, to the machine. They definitely took it to the man, as it were. And I really admire them. But nonetheless, deep in their heart, they were peaceful. And then the last thing, in terms of the system, that's the attaching or affiliating system, is to be loving. And that's my version, Shane, of what you do every day. I do gratitude, but I also, when I remember to focus on being both also grateful, peaceful, and loving. Mm-hmm. And those three together tend to tip the brain. By doing that mental activity, we tip the brain increasingly into that realized state of contentment and wisdom, where it truly is grateful, peaceful, and loving.
Mm-hmm. I find so much less conflict since I've started to look always for the good in everything and everyone.
Yeah.
So no matter what the situation is, be it you're like, if you're in a situation, I can use a small example that a lot of people might have on a regular basis that seems to be extremely popular in Canada anyways, is quarrels with your telephone company.
Oh, I'm sure we have them here too.
It seems to be a huge one that everyone I talk with. And you know what? I always got into the quarrels with my telephone company on a regular basis, and I got into the anger of it and the lashing out at it. And then when I started to come from a place of love and understand that that person also only wants to come from a place of love, because that's inherently the human condition, and our connection with the divinity is pure love. We want to be loved.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to understand that it's not about them, and it's not about me, it's about the situation. When I approach it from a place of love and a place of understanding, and I listen to them, they listen to me.
Yeah.
And then communication becomes much greater. So whether you're talking about a relationship with a partner, or a relationship with someone you're talking to for 3 minutes, or a relationship with your parent, it's all the same. You have to listen to their heart. Sometimes you have to get past what they're saying and go directly into the feeling of it. It's more about the feeling and intention of what they're saying than it is the actual words that are coming from their mouths.
Right, I think that's true.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that I've come to really appreciate, this is I guess the more tough-minded part of me, the real importance of practice. And then I think it's also grounded in all the traditions. They all talk about the importance of practice. In other words, it's great to get a new perspective, but what people need to do again and again and again is to incline the mind in a more positive direction and actually
mm-hmm.
take on inside the tendencies inside that are reactive, or as Roseanne was saying earlier, are, you know, angry at their partner or jealous or overly reactive to small slights, or fearful about really speaking up
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
speaking from their heart and being grave and being assertive and being strong and real to really name what they need in the relationship. And so, you know, I'm a big believer in practice and kind of just plugging away, which is why I wanted to write what I wrote, because I thought, you know, there is so much wisdom these days, but a lot of it doesn't boil down to actual doable methods that people can use in daily life, you know,
mm-hmm.
who actually want to transform themselves over time, whether it's, you know, someone who just wants to pick up a book and do, you know, a little thing to not be so cranky at work, or people, you know, like myself, and I think both of you, who are householders in the West, but have a very strong motivation toward the upper reaches, you know, of spiritual realization.
Mm-hmm.
How can we, as householders, because there's no phenomenon like this in the East. In other words, most people in the East are either monastics or they're fairly everyday folks who are kind of in the culture of their religion, but are not a strong contemplative practitioners themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we have historically is unprecedented in Europe and North America and the West, where you've got a lot of people who are doing serious practice, yet who are holding jobs, paying mortgages, you know, having partners, living in the world, you know,
mm-hmm.
sex, drugs, and rock and roll, at least sex and rock and roll, and, you know, at least some of the
time. Party
you know,
time.
There you are. So how do you do that in a way that you don't get caught by greed, hatred, and delusion, because
mm-hmm.
the brain keeps trying to draw us back down into that undertow? To me, it boils down to practice. You've got to keep practicing. Anyway, so that's what I wanted to write about.
That's fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, thank you so much, Rick, for this. We've pretty much used up the whole hour here now, and I just want to make sure everybody knows where to get more information again. The main sources are buddhasbrain.com and also wisebrain.org. Is there anywhere that you're going to be going out speaking, presenting, that people can catch you in person?
Yeah, buddhasbrain.com will take them to my personal website, which has a calendar on it,
okay.
Which lists, you know, where I'm teaching. I'm doing a lot of teaching, including I'll be on the east coast of America, in northern New England area, Boston, and that neck of the woods in March. Also, I'm talking with people about doing a workshop in Ontario, actually. By the way, I'm very fond of Canada. You know, I tell my kids, marry a Canadian and you'll have options. But anyway,
I'm very fond of Canada as well.
Yeah, really. Every time I cross the border, frankly, I kind of take a big breath and go, okay. But anyway, so I hope to come up there this year, actually, in the Ontario area and do a workshop. But that's not scheduled.
Wonderful.
Yet. But people can see more. And also, I should add, on my website, they can see my newsletter. I send out a newsletter weekly that's free and really cool. It's actually gotten great response. It's called Just One Thing. It's the idea of just one simple practice each week, that if you focus on that one little thing, like this week is Take Refuge. The week before, or a few weeks before, was Be Grateful, for example. But anyway, if you just focus on one thing, you can change your life.
That's fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Rick. I really appreciate you being here today. You know, to our listeners, thank you so much for joining us on Vivid Life Radio. Tune in next week. We've got Carol Richardson, author of The Art of Extreme Self-Care. That's January 20th at 2 p.m. Eastern. And Shane, do you want to sign off as well here?
I just wanted to really thank everyone for listening to the show today, and I'd really like to thank Rick for coming on and sharing his wisdom with us and with our listeners. And it really warms my heart to have each one of you listen, and I know that we'll all learn and we're all on this journey together. And again, it's really wonderful to have you all here. Thank you so much for being part of the Vivid Life team. And just learn from today that we need to come from a place of gratitude and from a place of love and from a place of empathy and understanding, and just try and be and do the best that you can every day to be the light and to be love. And again, thank you very much for listening to Vivid Life Radio. Stay tuned next week for Cheryl Richardson on Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern, and have an absolutely amazing day.
Thanks so much, everyone. Have a great day.